So you are what you eat. This phrase has come to us via quite a tortuous route. Anthelme Brillat-Savarin wrote in Physiology du Gout ou Méditation de Gastronomie Transcendante in 1826, saying, "Tell me what you eat and I will tell you what you are." In an essay titled Concerning Spiritualism and Materialism, 1863 to 1864, Ludwig Andreas Feuerbach wrote, "Der Mensch ist, was ist." So that translates into English as "man is what he eats." Neither Brillat-Savarin or Feuerbach meant their quotations to be taken literally. They were stating that the food one eats has a bearing on one's state of mind or health. The actual phrase didn't emerge in English until sometime later. In the 1920s and 30s, the nutritionist Victor Lindler, who was a strong believer in the idea that food controls health, developed the catabolic diet. Now, that view gained some adherence at the time, and the earliest known printed example is from an advert for beef in a 1923 edition of the Bridgeport Telegraph for United Meat Markets. In Australia, as elsewhere, nearly half of the population will experience a mental health problem at some point in their lives, and this means even people who are not personally affected are likely to know someone who has experienced such an illness. And research now suggests that depression and dementia are affected by the quality of our diets across the life course. Indeed, studies from countries as diverse as Norway, Spain, Japan, China, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Australia show people whose diets are healthier are less likely to experience depression. The most recent evidence points to the importance of the mothers' diets for the mental and physical health of their children. And I know Dr. Raymond Peet has been very keen to point out that mothers' nutrition is extremely important in setting up the child's future. Dr. Peet is with us in the show in a few minutes here. We'll be introducing Dr. Peet and hearing his perspective on You Are What You Eat, because I know he has some very unique ways and perspectives of looking at this subject. Now, the role of nutrition on development is an obvious one, but mostly ignored or overlooked in the perspective of health and well-being. And the concept of homeostasis, that is the constancy of the inner environment or internal milieu, was first originally formulated by the French physiologist Claude Bernard, who was alive from 1813 to 1878, and he was a French physiologist. Well, Dr. Peet, thanks so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as always, people who have tuned into the show who may not have heard you, I would appreciate if you would give an outline of your academic and professional background before we get into tonight's subject.
After I had studied in the humanities and taught art and English and various things, I decided to go back to graduate school in biology at 1968 University of Oregon, and wrote my dissertation on the age-related changes in oxidative metabolism in the hamster uterus and how it affects fertility with aging. And that involved hormones and nutrition, among other things, and how the environment affects those factors, especially efficiency of metabolism using oxygen. And since then, I've been writing and doing consultations and trying to figure things out, still working on some of those same themes, oxidative metabolism and aging, the whole idea of metabolic efficiency is one of my current themes. And Lindar, that you just mentioned, his idea of the catabolic diet was to choose foods for their metabolic inefficiency, because people eating to satisfy their appetite tend to get fat on the available foods. And he found that he could get people to lose fat very consistently and quickly by choosing certain foods that increased their metabolic rate so that they could burn calories faster than they were eating them. And that was in the 1920s when he did that research. And just by chance, a few years later, George Burr, who was studying the effect of fats in the diet, found that if he made his rats deficient in the unsaturated fatty acids, they burned calories at a terrific rate, as much as 50% faster than normal. And he thought that was bad. And he became very popular with the agricultural industry because they found that feeding those polyunsaturated fats to pigs and chickens and such, they would gain weight quickly and cheaply without eating very much food.
Right.
Just the opposite of what Lindler wanted to do was to find foods that would decrease the efficiency of the metabolism so that people would produce heat without gaining weight.
Do you know what kind of foods Lindler advocated?
Lots of fruits and vegetables,
okay.
Including fruit juices.
Okay. Huh. Okay.
And the standard nutritional education emphasizes the concept of a specific dynamic action or the thermogenic
right.
effect of various foods. And it's widely recognized that eating protein increases your body temperature and heat production
okay.
by quite a bit, 15 or 20%, and sugar a little less than that, fat not quite so much.
I know you've mentioned, I don't mean to interrupt, but I know you've mentioned quite a lot in the past about coconut being thermogenic.
Coconut oil. Yeah, I think there are many reasons for that, and the coconut is a very highly saturated fat, and it happens that the unsaturated fats interfere with the mitochondrial use of oxygen in several ways by producing free radicals, inflammation, and by interfering in a variety of ways with thyroid hormone function.
Okay.
So all along the line, the polyunsaturated fats slow down oxidative metabolism. And so if your body is soaked in these conventional seed oils, then when you eat coconut oil, especially the shorter, very mobile fatty acids that are only a third or half as long as the standard fats, these move into cells very quickly and oxidize without that anti-thyroid effect that the seed oils mostly have.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so Victor Landler then came up with the paper on a catabolic diet, so the opposite of anabolism, which is to build muscle, and catabolism is to break it down with the production of heat.
In the 50s and 60s, people were experimenting with what kind of diet is efficient for losing fat
okay.
and still maintaining your health.
Uh-huh.
And they did experiments in which people would just have pure water for 10 days or 14 days, and then they would analyze what happened to their bodies, and they found that they lost almost pure fat, a pure protein during that time, very
right.
little fat.
Right, right, okay.
And if they ate maybe 600 to 800 calories per day during that same 10 to 14 days, they would lose mostly fat and very little protein.
Interesting. Because that's the muscle mass that a person loses when they fast, or, for example, if they're using, like you said, that water for 10 days, that you actually, the first thing that you would lose is your muscle mass, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why so many women are dieting constantly and getting fatter. Because
explain that a little, will you?
If they eat an extremely low-calorie diet, creating stress, the high cortisol and other stress hormones cause them to break down their protein, and their big muscles shrink.
Mm-hmm.
So that a typical dieter you can hardly see her calf muscles to become so atrophied. And the big skeletal muscles, even at rest, burn fat to maintain themselves.
Okay.
Almost a pure fat diet when they're at rest.
Okay.
And so the more dieting they do, if they do it extremely, the smaller their muscles get, and the easier it is to get fat the next time they eat a normal diet.
Right. And you said with the addition of how much fat was the addition that caused the protein to be conserved in that diet?
They fed them different foods. Like a mixed diet, a little protein, a little carbohydrate, and not especially a low fat intake, but just so that they were able to get some of their calorie needs from the diet rather than from their tissues. Because when you're in the first day on a fast, your body uses up the sugar that's stored as glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as your blood sugar falls because you've used up your stores, then your cortisol rises. First the adrenaline, then the cortisol. And the cortisol, having no food available, it starts converting your thymus gland and big skeletal muscles mostly to free amino acids, which then can be, some of them are converted to glucose.
Mm-hmm.
To feed your blood cells and brain and eyes and so on.
Yeah.
Because those have an absolute requirement for glucose. And so even a plain sugar diet to supply that minimal amount to your brain and blood cells require, that will greatly prevent the rising cortisol and loss of good tissue.
Okay. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM, and from 7:30 until the end of the show, you're invited to call in with any questions either related or unrelated to this month's topic of You Are What You Eat. We're joined by Dr. Raymond Peet, and he has a wealth of experience and knowledge that he's currently sharing. And Dr. Peet, it's well established. I just want to jump onto this next subject of and probably spend a little bit more time on what's coming out in science about the what they call the microbiome of a person's body. And it's well established that your gut apparently is your second brain, providing more input to your brain than the brain provides to it. And this is why your gut health is largely related in your gut bacteria, including your mental health and emotional well-being. There's quite a few journal articles that have come out in 2013 and 2014 about the microbiome and making links specifically to disease processes and the microbiome. And I know that you advocate several dietary factors that I think inadvertently are modulating, if you like, the microbiome. And I think the science bringing about the explanation of the microbiome is now justifying what you're saying about, for example, indigestible fibers like bamboo shoots, carrots, etc., as being healthful in terms of their modulating the microbial content of the gut, and along with things like cascara. I know you talk a lot about cascara, not just for bowel motility and improving bowel function and waste clearance, but also because the cascara itself has a cyclic structure quite similar to tetracycline in terms of it being a similar antibiotic in the gut, and how this affecting bacterial colonies in a positive way to remove bad bacteria actually allows normal healthy bacteria to flourish and therefore modulate the gut as an organism.
Yeah, and it's interesting that both Imodin from cascara or Chinese rhubarb and such, and tetracycline and the related minocycline and doxycycline, these are anti-inflammatory as well as antiseptic, and Imodin and the tetracyclines have a surprising range of good effects. Anti-inflammatory and probably mood-improving. Minocycline is being found to prevent, possibly improve dementia, Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And Imodin has, every year it seems like there are half a dozen new functions that are found for Imodin, including improving the flora of the intestine.
Imodin, am I right in thinking that Imodin is also present in aloe vera?
Yeah. Lots of plants.
Yeah.
Generally, they're laxative plants.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But it isn't the typical purging kind of laxative. If the cascara isn't properly aged,
right,
it does have an irritating purging effect, but aging makes it insoluble in water comparatively, and it loses the irritating inflammatory property and becomes anti-inflammatory and sedative, and
right,
it actually increases the production of energy while having a nerve calming sedative effect.
And this again is that red compound that you've mentioned in the past that is energetically favorable in terms of its both electron quenching activity and its anti-inflammatory activity.
Sort of a sideline to my research in graduate school on what causes oxidative metabolism to go down with aging, I would look for all kinds of plant and animals that were colored and do extracts and look for things that stimulated oxidative metabolism. And I got the interest partly from St. George's work. He found that the color of cells is closely connected to the oxidative process. For example, the deep maroon or purple color of the liver and certain areas of the brain are deeply pigmented. He knew that it didn't have any of the usual functions of pigment, and he found that it was related to, he knew that semiconductors are generally black because of a peculiar electronic arrangement that causes them to absorb all the light that hits them.
Mm-hmm.
And he figured that the life process involves semiconduction, and so pigments are especially relevant to the use of energy in living things.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in terms of transporting electrons from one phase to another and therefore carrying either electrical charge as a form of energy.
I think last month we were talking about methylene blue as an artificial electron transporter, and it can, like vitamin C, vitamin C in this normal form isn't a pigment, but it has some of the same electronic behaviors. Both of those can pick up electrons from nutrients such as glucose and pass them into the mitochondria. And even if the first two units of the mitochondrion are damaged, methylene blue and vitamin C and probably many other natural pigments can deliver energy electrons down to the third complex of the mitochondrion and allow it to keep functioning even after a serious damage.
Yeah.
And so part of that function is to stop producing free radicals, which are mostly produced in the upper part of the electron transport chain as it's being damaged.
Okay, so getting on to the kind of wider topic of you are what you eat, I think probably just to bring out some of those things that you mentioned for many different conditions or processes that can be corrected by various, I mean, you prescribe a lot of dietary advice in terms of modulating the way people's physiology is working and therefore bringing people back to good health in a very natural way with no side effects. It's not a drug orientated approach. It's very nutritional. And I know obviously you're very keen on saturated fats as opposed to the polys and the polyunsaturates as being very detrimental to health. Obviously sugar, I know you talk a lot about fruit juices and fructose in particular as an energy promoter. In terms of you are what you eat, the gut bacteria and the bacteria within the bowel, what do you know from the studies that have been done on for mood, for example, and or autism in children that have shown some definite correlation between gut bacteria and their intestinal flora, and the intestinal flora in populations that are not suffering with autism, and how I think in the future perhaps the antibiotics that are very useful, and I know you're an advocate of antibiotics, and I know most people unfortunately have a mistaken belief that antibiotics are bad. I think just from the cases where maybe females are getting thrush after using antibiotics, it conjures up this kind of popular myth or popular notion that antibiotics are bad, but actually we know that they're very positive influences on our physiology and especially on our gut for wiping out bad bacteria. But what's your thought about altering the so-called microbiome of the body so that specific bacteria that are known to be detrimental to health can be eradicated and leaving the positive bacteria behind to actually influence the populations within the digestive tract?
About 1990, I read an article from a fertility clinic in which a lot of the women were trying to conceive, and the fertilized ovum just wouldn't implant. And the doctors thought that it might indicate that there was an infection in the uterus, so they gave all of their patients a course of antibiotics. And besides improving their fertility, a lot of the patients said suddenly that their chronic headaches had disappeared. Hmm. And so they gave them hormone tests to see what was going on, causing both fertility to improve and headaches and other symptoms to disappear. They found that the antibiotics had lowered their cortisol and estrogen production and increased progesterone in their serum, explaining the increased fertility, but a whole range of other symptoms related to stress. And following reading about that, I suggested that because I knew that the estrogen, which is excreted by a healthy liver in the bile, is much of it is reabsorbed and stays in the circulation if you have a sluggish intestine. And so I suggested that if they eat a carrot every day to stimulate the intestine, the carrot will bind the bile and lower the serum estrogen level. That's now generally accepted that any fiber tends to lower your absorption of estrogen from the bile.
Mm-hmm.
And within 3 or 4 days, these people tested their estrogen, cortisol, and progesterone, and it was doing the same thing that the synthetic antibiotics had done.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing about carrots, and they can get very tiresome if you eat one a day for years, I looked around for other foods that were antiseptic and might have that same effect. And bamboo shoots are something that you don't get too tired of.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have much flavor, so you can put them in a lot of different foods. And cooking a bamboo shoot doesn't destroy the fiber the way a cooked carrot does.
Yeah.
So you have to eat raw carrots or cooked bamboo shoots.
Do you know of any other fibers, Dr. Pete, that have that effect?
Mushrooms, I think.
Mushrooms?
Because they grow underground and in a very decaying environment, they have to have powerful antibiotics.
Interesting. Do you not? Okay, you surprised me when you say mushrooms, because I wouldn't have thought that would have been naturally one thing that you would have said to someone would be okay to eat. But you're.
Well, I don't know anything about mushrooms, actually, but accept that principle.
Yeah.
That they are
okay.
Antiseptic and
okay.
They have a high value protein, and the protein happens to be pretty low in methionine, which
okay.
is the most toxic of the amino acids.
Interesting.
And methionine are the amino acids that most slow your metabolism. And so you're getting two of the metabolic stimulants, lowering the estrogen, disinfecting your intestine.
Yeah. Okay, hold it there, Dr. Pete, for a moment, because I think we have one or two callers on the air. So let's start with our first caller and see where we're going with this. Caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Hello, is this me?
Yes, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Hey, I'm from Eastern Oregon.
Eastern Oregon. Okay, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I just have a question. The last month I developed very, very high blood pressure that spikes very high.
Okay.
And I don't have it run in my family, and I never had it before. I had normal.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did is about 2 months ago I had my T3 medicine increased a
mm-hmm.
little bit,
mm-hmm.
and I got heart palpitations.
Okay.
So I was titrating down off of that for over a period of 6 weeks, and I still had the heart palpitations until I went to nothing. And then I heard your show last month, and I started magnesium, and the heart palpitations went away.
Yeah, Dr. Pete mentioned that, didn't he, for palpitations? Yeah.
Thank you so much. but I also, in October, went on a silly little thing where I was trying to increase my body temperature, because even with the thyroid supplement, it still is kind of low.
Okay.
And I heard that if you eat a lot of more sugar and salt in high-dense foods,
mm-hmm.
that you can do that. So I increased my salt quite a bit, and I wasn't worried because I always had low blood pressure, medium-low, you
right.
know, normal.
Uh-huh.
So then over this last month, my blood pressure has just skyrocketed. And it was kind of scary, and I went to the doctor. Now I'm on medicine. But I was wondering, could coming down off of the thyroid, which I went back on, and also that high salt diet, could that have contributed to this really crazy high blood pressure?
Well, first things first, let's just, how much salt were you using?
Quite a bit. I just poured on everything, and just throughout the day, I never measured it or anything.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. But Dr.
More than I normally did.
Yeah.
Probably. My guess is maybe 3 or 4,000 milligrams. Is that like almost like 2 days worth in 1 day? And I did that for a couple, 3 weeks. Then I stopped.
Okay. Dr. Pete.
Was your TSH measured as part of the thyroid exam?
When I first was on, I've been on T4 for 6 months, and when they first started it, it was like 3, but then it went down to below 0. Yeah, it's like 0.03 or something. It's way low.
TSH causes a lot of the symptoms of hypothyroidism, and so a T3 will cause your T4 to go down, and if it goes too low, your TSH might come up. And TSH does a lot of things that go with hypothyroidism, including high blood pressure. It makes your red cells more rigid, your blood and serum more viscous, and it tightens up small blood vessels. Everything it does tends to create higher blood pressure. So if your TSH is currently extremely low, then you probably should have your other hormones, such as adrenaline, checked to see what might be causing that.
But Dr. Pete, you always advocate a TSH as close to zero as possible, just because it's a fairly inflammatory chaperone molecule anyway, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So caller, your question, have you understood the answer, or?
Well, I'm from what I understand is that my THC, if it gets pretty low, the T3 will make it lower, and if you increase, okay, I think I got mixed up. Sorry. So something about the TSH, the extra T3, can cause it to start rising up again, or am I incorrect?
If you had lowered your TSH by taking fairly large amounts of T4 thyroxine.
It was 25 micrograms.
Oh, well, that isn't very much. And,
no, but it was still low. It got low under one. It became 0.03 or 4. It was really low. And then several months later, they incorporated T3 at 25, and I cut it in fours and spread it throughout the day, and I was doing really well. And that went on for a month, and then they increased it another 25, which made it 50, and I split those throughout the day in fours. And then, lo and behold, I started having heart palpitations at night and all these other symptoms, and so I titrated down. And I don't know. I went to the doctor because I was a little frightened, and they said they checked my thyroid, and they said it's fine. But, you know, I know that their numbers might not be optimal.
Were the other things like albumin and blood sugar okay?
They didn't say. I don't know. I suppose I can find out, and they probably have the records, so I can find out about the albumin. They didn't say. They said all my lab was fine, what they said.
Do you get a fairly balanced diet, like with milk and cheese and eggs? And
yes, I stopped doing that silly little thing I did for 3 weeks there with the extra, with the high dense, different kind of eating. And prior to that and since then, I drink milk, a quart and a half or so, and organic, fresh squeezed orange juice, quart and plus, and cheese and eggs. Yeah. And Great Lakes gelatin.
Is there anything that might be irritating your digestive system? Sometimes that can cause stress and increased pressure.
No. But do you think that maybe they may say that my numbers are fine and maybe they may not be as optimal as they could be? Like the TSH and the, I'm sorry, what numbers did you ask?
Yeah, it's good to have albumin well above 40.
Okay.
And blood glucose anywhere 70 to 110 should be okay. And potassium and sodium should be around the middle of the scale.
Okay. Well, they put me on medicine, so now I'm on medicine, so I'm a little leery about it, but it was pretty scary. It was up to like 200 and over 100, and then it would kind of go down, and then it would fluctuate in between that, but never back to normal.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like an alarm reaction, a stress-related alarm reaction of adrenaline producing that kind of blood pressure, because what do you think about thyroid hormone, Dr. Pete, and blood pressure? I mean, it's actually a regulator of high blood pressure. When people get high blood pressure generally, they are subject to adrenaline and that other sympathetic, hormones that drive blood pressure up. And thyroid hormone specifically antagonizes that and brings blood pressure down into
it. Yeah, especially when it comes on quickly, like suggests that it's adrenaline or maybe serotonin. The reason I asked about any irritating food, if you don't dissolve the gelatin thoroughly, sometimes that can cause gas and irritation by feeding bacteria in the intestine.
I don't dissolve it. I kind of put it in my orange juice and stir it in cold orange juice and drink it that way, so I don't, like, cook it or anything. But I mix it in with the orange juice. But I don't feel like my stomach's irritated, but I don't know. Maybe it is, and I don't know it. I don't feel like it's causing gas. But I thought if I started back up on the T3, like I had, and I've been on it for several weeks, maybe 3 weeks now, that maybe eventually it would normalize the blood pressure. Is that a possibility?
Is your pulse rate about where it was?
About where it was prior to all this, or
yeah. Is it in the range of 70 to 90?
Yeah, it's always been around that, more towards the 70. Yeah, it hasn't. My pulse hasn't changed too much.
Magnesium and calcium are two nutrients that help to lower blood pressure, but potassium is probably the most powerful. Orange juice is a very good source of potassium, and so a quart of orange juice spread out through the day, the amount of potassium.
Well, I'm taking extra magnesium since that helped with the palpitations, and I drink lots of milk and orange juice.
And one other nutrient that can powerfully lower blood pressure is vitamin K. For example, the drops that deliver 1 milligram of vitamin K per drop. I know a doctor who, for several months, had his blood pressure had been 240 over 140. No, 240 over 70. And within 2 or 3 weeks of using a lot of vitamin K, his pressure came down to 140 over 70.
Okay.
So vitamin K, in terms of a daily trial of vitamin K, what do you think would be a reasonable...
Well, that doctor who got such extreme results was taking 40 or 50 milligrams per day.
Right, 40 or 50 drops of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right, I wrote all this down. Thank you so much. I also, they put me on medicine now, and I'm on... lisinopril plus diuretic with it. So that might kind of add to the mix now somehow, I'm sure, probably.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be difficult to tell what your proper blood pressure was all the time you're using something like lisinopril.
Yeah, I just started it. Yeah. I just started that, last 2 weeks, and now they add, and it didn't help, and so now they added it with a diuretic.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know what to say, you know.
Yeah, it definitely sounds something more than anything to do with your thyroid that you've been using, because it's definitely very short and very quick to come on. You know, it's a very rapid onset. So, as lots of people are saying, it's much more indicative of something hormone or catecholamine based that would have such a rapid onset. Okay, yeah, it's probably a little bit outside of the scope of this talk show just to comment on this any further, though, but I appreciate your call.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you too. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Okay, so what other callers do we have? The next caller, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Missouri.
Okay, hi, go ahead. Hello?
This is David from Missouri.
Yeah, go ahead, David. I think we got some interference between your...
Yeah, well, you know, just so you know, normally you would be able to hear the radio show when you're waiting on the phone, and it's not doing that, so I had to listen to that.
Unfortunately, there's some hum here in the studio that I can hear, and whenever the light's flashing, I also hear that too, so I think there's some kind of... It's not uncommon, unfortunately.
That's what I was saying. Normally you can hear the radio show while you have the phone, you know, listening to the phone, while you're put on hold, and you can't do that.
Got
for
it.
Some reason, so they're doing something differently. So,
I'm not sure.
One of the things, does listening to the news cause high blood pressure?
Quite probably, if it's bad news.
Yeah, that was one of the things you didn't ask her. So I quit listening to the news, and my blood pressure went down.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway, I've heard for years that coconut oil is an antibiotic and also antifungal.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, I wanted to ask Dr. Pete if that is true, and then how would that work if that were the case? And then also, I think along the same lines is, you know, I've heard him, Dr. Pete, I've heard you say that when you eat starch, that the starch is able to get into the bloodstream and creates all sorts of problems in capillaries and different vessels, and that the saturated fat helps to prevent that. So how does saturated fat help along those lines as well? Is it somehow coating the bacteria and the molecules of starch?
Yeah, it slows digestion enough that keeps things in an emulsion that the enzymes have time to start breaking down the starch particles. It isn't known exactly why that happens, but Gerhardt, I forget his name at the moment, the man who did the persorption research showed that the starch without fat would immediately in 15 or 20 minutes show up in your bloodstream, but with fat, it didn't show up in the bloodstream, and it probably is because it gives it time to break down a little bit. But the I think the most important effect of the fat is that germicidal action, suppressing the bacteria that, if your digestion is really working right, your whole small intestine should be sterile, free of bacteria. And sluggish digestion, low thyroid people often get bacteria growing all the way up close to their stomach. And in that case, when you eat any starch, it feeds the bacteria. The bacteria produce endotoxin, which causes your intestine to produce nitric oxide and serotonin and histamine. And the nitric oxide is a very powerful poison of oxidative metabolism. So the combination of bacteria, especially in the small intestine, and any kind of a starch that isn't quickly absorbed into your bloodstream is going to feed the bacteria, increase the nitric oxide, and basically poison your respiratory metabolism all through your body. Many years ago, people experimenting with germ-free animals, their whole life, they're isolated from bacteria, and they have a very healthy life, low mortality until extreme old age, and they eat about 20 or 30% more calories than the ordinary germ-bearing mice, but they are leaner, much, much smaller fat deposits, and they don't suffer from anxiety. And how to explain that, it means that the bacteria are producing something that poisons your metabolism. George Burr's research with the polyunsaturated fats, he demonstrated that these fats have a similar poisoning effect on your oxidative metabolism, so that without them, the animals burn 30 to 50% more energy without getting fat. So the polyunsaturated fats are contributing to the nitric oxide production, but definitely the the bacteria eating starch are a major source of this anti-metabolic material.
And, you know, so is the coconut oil, because of the short chain and the medium chain, possibly better in that action that you just described than, say, butter?
No, all
does
of
it really
all the saturated fats are pretty good antifungals and antibacterials, but I think the shorter chain, athlete's foot remedy that kills fungus very efficiently is an 11-carbon saturated fat or a monounsaturated. And the shorter they are, the faster they diffuse. And apparently they're more active as a toxin or antiseptic if they're a little shorter than the stearic acid of butter. But
okay.
Soap is traditionally known as a good antiseptic, and that's usually made with a stearic acid.
You know, Dr. Pete, based on several things that you've recommended, I grow different bamboos, and so I can't wait till the spring because I'm going to try this soup, and I'm just curious what you think about it. I'm going to use a Acme juicer, and I'm going to get the juice from potatoes, and then I was going to cook the bamboo sprouts in there. And now that I for some reason, I always thought that you didn't think that mushrooms were possibly good, but I would love to have shiitake mushrooms in that soup. And then put plenty of butter and coconut oil in that. Do you think that's do you think that's a decent soup?
I think so, but it's really good to make sure you don't get toxic mushrooms.
Well, you know, the only thing I grow is shiitakes, which is that possibly a good mushroom? You know?
I'll have to interject here and tell you that the only thing that I'm allergic to is shiitake mushroom. I came out in a widespread body rash, and I couldn't explain it first time around. I thought it was very strange, and I'd contracted something serious. I was seriously worried about it. It took about 4 weeks for it to resolve. And then again, about 4 years later, the same thing happened again. And I made a connection. I made a connection to shiitake mushrooms. Now, as you know, I'm a naturopathic doctor, and I work with extracts, and I make extracts of shiitake mushrooms. And the third time round, when I was handling shiitake mushroom powder, the same thing happened. I got a widespread rash over my face and my hands, where I'd been not just handling the product, but must have breathed some of it in and got it in contact with my face. So I find it a very allergenic product. So I would just put that out there that
about. Growing them for a while and eating them, but I've been trying not to, you know, consume too many. But I've never seen a direct relationship to any kind of problems. Who knows? You know?
That's the only thing that I've ever been reactive to.
You know, Dr. Pete has talked about Gerald Pollack a few times, and I listened to an interview recently that I thought might be interesting for everybody. He was talking about grounding, which I think I've mentioned before on a show, about, you know, like walking barefoot and then the electrons flowing into the body from the earth. And one of the things that he was mentioning, he said that, of course, there's no scientific studies to validate this, but he, you know, he's really into the idea of structured water. And he was saying how walking barefoot and getting natural sunlight could very possibly be helping to structure the water in the body. I thought that was pretty interesting. Kind of, you know, puts a few things that you've been talking about for a while. Does that make sense at all to you, Dr. Pete?
Well, definitely the flow of electrons is the basic thing that structures water. When I talk about energy and structure, I'm thinking about the fine layers of water adjoining proteins and fat in the cells. That's created and maintained by the flow of electrons, mostly from glucose to oxygen through the various catalysts. And when that's interrupted, when oxygen isn't able to keep pulling the electrons, and it's this flow of electrons that generates the structure, just like if you stir a pot of spaghetti, all the strings line up in a certain direction. That sort of thing is what happens microscopically. The energy flow generates structure, and that has all of the consequences of cell differentiation.
Yeah, and one of the things I didn't mention that he had talked about, which totally aligns with what you said, is he said the red wavelengths of light are what help to structure the water, which I thought was really interesting.
Oh, a German researcher, a young guy named André Sommer, has been doing extremely interesting research showing exactly that the red light itself organizes the structure of water.
Interesting.
So I think it's important to do like Adam and Eve and walk naked in the garden in the sunlight.
Okay, David, I appreciate your call. But
I was joking. I thought I would get a laugh.
That'd be a great idea. I appreciate your call, but I think we have another one lined up here. So to get next call. Thank you. I know, Dr. Pete, you do talk about red light a lot as a free radical quenching substance and anti-inflammatory. So
And it desorbs nitric oxide from the cytochrome oxidase.
Okay, somebody called in during that dialogue there, and I think they've left the question with the engineer. So if the question wants to be read out, then perhaps we can go from there.
Oh, yeah, she was just basically wondering. She said she's 64 years old and wondering about under-eye puffiness, a 64-year-old lady.
Sounds like low thyroid. But, Dr. Pete, what do you think?
Sometimes low thyroid or something missing in the diet can be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
Most often it's low thyroid. For example, if your thyroid is chronically low, your cholesterol is likely to be chronically above average.
Right.
As a compensation, because thyroid should turn cholesterol into the steroids progesterone, pregnenolone, and DHEA, and those should regulate the water.
Uh-huh.
And the inside, outside the cell, a balance of the water.
Okay. I think we have another caller who's just called in just a moment ago. So let's see. Let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. And where are you from?
Okay, let me turn my radio off. Hang on a second. Let's see. I'm from the North Coast here.
Okay.
I had a question. What do you know about sulfites in wine?
Mm-hmm. Very allergenic.
Digestive problems.
Yeah.
And are wines, companies that produce wine required to say that sulfites are in wine? Do you know anything about
sure.
that?
Sure. Yeah. It's a labeling recommendation for sure, and sulfite-free wine can be labeled sulfite-free. Other wine that isn't normally has to be labeled contains sulfites, and I know Dr. Pete has always mentioned that sulfites are very allergenic, can cause many different symptoms from headache to rash to respiratory disorders. But Dr. Pete, what else do you have to say about sulfites?
Digestion.
Potentially very pro-inflammatory, and it interferes with the handling of electrons. I think that's why it is so dangerously allergenic for so many people. I've had the experience of sulfited wines that gave me a vertigo and extreme symptoms for several days, which I think were from causing inflammation of the intestine.
Okay, so just allergenic in general.
My question refers messing up a digestive system and causing pain in digestion. That's what I'm wondering if it's related to that.
Well, red wines contain their own histamine, which can cause symptoms in a lot of people.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye.
Okay. Well, I'd stop right there, Dr. Pete, and just thank you so much for spending your time again this month with the show. I just want to let people know how to find out more information about you.
Okay,
thanks so much. Okay, well, thanks to the callers that have called in. And, yeah, again, there's certainly more scope for expanding the discussion on You Are What You Eat. Dr. Raymond Peet's website has a wealth of information where people can find lots of articles that are fully referenced scientific articles. His website is www.raypeat.com. And then there's, like I say, probably something in the order of 40 to 50 articles on various different subjects, all of which are his specialism in hormones and endocrine subjects. So his website, www.raypeat.com. We can be contacted Monday through Friday during business hours at 1-888-WBM-HERB. And, yeah, this is a couple of days until the winter solstice, the darkest time of the year. Christmas is coming up. I hope everybody here is paying attention to what it is they're going to eat over Christmas. Lots of, hopefully, no polyunsaturates. Hopefully, people are cooking with butter and animal fats, and making sure that what you eat is organic. Again, like I said, you know, you are what you eat, and the food chain is an extremely toxic product. The whole food industry is extremely permeated with lots of different chemicals now that make food not what it used to be. So when people say, oh, it's not like my grandmother used to cook, that's because she was cooking with real food. And unfortunately, a lot of our food now is not particularly real. So yeah, always eat organic, source and support organic production, and watch what you eat. Until the third Friday of next month, Merry Christmas.